Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. It's Friday, and it's time for our Media Roundtable, the day we connect you with journalists to discuss major stories of the week. And on today's show, we are speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning reporters. The Tampa Bay Times staff writers Will Hobson and Michael LaForgia won a Pulitzer for exposing a Florida government's agency's inhumane treatment of Hillsborough County's homeless population, including children. The agency funneled millions of public dollars to slumlords and placed families in unsafe living conditions. The Pulitzer Committee praised the reporters for their, quote, relentless investigation and noted that the revelations led to swift reforms. The stories actually led to the most significant reform of the county's social service programs in 20 years. Will Hobson is a staff reporter at the Tampa Bay Times in Florida, and Michael LaForgia is also a staff reporter there. They are the youngest journalists to win in the newspaper's history, and their prize is the first time the Times has won in the contest's local reporting category. Hi, Will and Michael. Congratulations, and thanks for coming on the show.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
Hi. Nice to have you.
Glad to be here.
And the Center for Public Integrity's Chris Hamby won a Pulitzer for his series, Breathless and Burdened, Dying from Black Lung, Buried by Law and Medicine. His year-long investigative series exposed how doctors and lawyers working at the behest of the coal industry helped deny benefit claims of coal miners who were sick and dying of black lung disease. This is the first Pulitzer for the Center for Public Integrity, where Chris Hamby is an investigative reporter, and he is leaving soon to join BuzzFeed, a social news and entertainment company. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show, and congratulations for your award.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have all of you. As we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note to give kudos to a reporter who did a good job, kind of like the work that you're all doing. Will, why don't we start off with you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Thrilled to see the Pulitzer Board award or honor some journalism that I thought really highlighted some major injustices going on. I think without the existence of agencies like the Tampa Bay Times or the Center for Public Integrity, this work wouldn't be done.
What really struck you about the other awards? I mean, it focused on everything from the Boston bombing to the NSA spying program. There was a lengthy report looking at just the increasing number of people on food stamps, the poor treatment of veterans.
Well, I personally was just very happy to see the board with the, very weighty public service medal give that to the coverage of the NSA surveillance tactics that we saw in the Washington Post and the Guardian last year. I think that, when we look back at journalism that was done in 2013, those were two series of reports that really did change the course of history. And regardless of where you fall politically and what was going on there, I think it was information that the public needed to know, and I'm glad it got the honor. Mm.
And that's Will Hobson, staff reporter at the Tampa Bay Times in Florida. And Michael LaForgia, what about you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I got to tell you, I'm probably about a week late on this for the most recent follow, but the Subsidized Squalor series by Amy Julia Harris of the Center for Investigative Reporting out there has just blown me away. I think that organization has got one of the premier investigative newsrooms, in the country right now, and I'm just excited every time they come out with something.
We did a show about this actually last week.
I saw that.
Yeah. Well, she does deserve big kudos for that series. Thank you. And what about you, Chris? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I want to give a big shout-out to Ken Ward, Jr., who is just a tremendous reporter at the Charleston Gazette in West Virginia. And this week, he continued his terrific coverage following the horrendous chemical spill of MCHM there that endangered 300,000 West Virginians with contaminated water. And this week, he followed up something that he's broken all along, which is that the CDC has failed along the way to take into account the possibility that West Virginians were being exposed to this chemical, not just through the water, but also through air, that it can be inhaled, and that they had no really, that they had essentially abandoned any attempt to set a safe inhalation level for this chemical about which we know very little. This is continuing with Ken's tremendous work. He could have easily gone to a larger market years ago, but he has chosen to stay in his native West Virginia, and he is the public service that he has provided over years to the people who live in that state has just been remarkable. So I would encourage people to read the Gazette and read Ken's blog, Coal Tattoo.
Huh.
I had the real pleasure of working with him before.
Wow, we should get him on one of our Friday shows.
Please do.
Yeah.
He's terrific.
It sounds great. Well, and I wanted to ask all of you, actually, just about the state of investigative journalism today, because, you know, it's so easy to slam the media for good reason, but I think a lot of the criticism is really geared towards television and just kind of how shallow it has become. But there's so much good reporting going on, especially when you look at all of the stories that won Pulitzers. The problem is, it seems that, you know, a lot of these stories have a hard time getting traction or getting the publicity they deserve. And Chris, you know, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, because you're leaving the Center for Public Integrity to go to BuzzFeed. And BuzzFeed has gotten a lot of publicity in the last year or so, along with so many new media ventures. So what do you see moving forward in terms of investigative reporting?
Well, I'm very excited about the future of investigative reporting. I think there was a time there where my views would have been a little more pessimistic. I had always grown up thinking, I'm going to work for a newspaper, and I'm going to, you know, start out on the courts and cops beat and work my way up to investigative desk eventually. But, you know, things have changed so much in just the time from my adolescence to now. And I think for a while it was, you know, it was all about the supposed decline of newspapers. But I think that's in some ways a little bit overblown. As my fellow guests today here have shown, there's a lot of terrific reporting going on at newspapers still. And then also you have this whole other sort of area that has stepped up, whether it's places like the Center for Public Integrity, which is, you know, doing online investigative, nonprofit, nonpartisan news, you know, other places like us, like ProPublica and the Center for Investigative Reporting, and local outlets as well that are popping up left and right doing the same thing. And then BuzzFeed is very exciting to me because they have found a successful way, it appears, to make money online and to have a large audience, yet they have now a significant commitment to being a mainstream news organization for the 21st century, and they have really, you know, put their money where their mouth is and you know, and invested in putting together of quite a formidable investigative team led by a tremendous editor, formerly of ProPublica and the Wall Street Journal. And I'm just very excited to see where all this goes.
And Will, what are your thoughts on this? What do you think is the future in newspapers? For example, you work at the Tampa Bay Times in Florida with all the focus on these new media ventures. What role do newspapers play going forward?
Well, I mean, ideally, the a more slimmed down version of the role we've played in the past. I mean, I think it, as newspapers, as we go through staff reductions, as we go through resource reductions, we just need to stop viewing ourselves as the paper of record in our region and logging each minor noteworthy event that happened. Instead, kind of take a step back and look for opportunities for stories that fall between, you know, our traditional beats, stories like, you know, the stories that Mike and I did last year that have not gone highlighted in the past. But I'd echo what Chris said, and I'm curious, if you don't mind, if I could ask Chris a question.
Sure.
She just went through this interview process. Do the folks at BuzzFeed, are they getting into long form and investigative work? Is that a profit-driven thing for them, or is it? Do they feel some type of? Because I mean, they could be humming along perfectly fine, making money with the native advertising model they have. I'm just curious what their motivations are, if they feel some obligation as a website that's drawing that many eyeballs to be getting out there and actually producing journalism.
Right. The way it has been described repeatedly to me by top people at BuzzFeed is that, you know, BuzzFeed, you know, yes, they could be kind of humming along doing a lot of stuff that people traditionally associate with BuzzFeed, you know, the lists and the quizzes and the GIFs and all that. You know, they really, all along, you know, it's been, their mission has been to do more, and they are quite serious about shifting and having not just the fun side, but also a really serious side. And they really view themselves as one of the media companies for the 21st century, and to be sort of a well-rounded media company, they feel like it's essential to have the serious reporting, and they feel like, in particular, a good investigative team is part of that. So, you know, investigative reporting is expensive, and they recognize that, and this is what they want, and they want this to build the BuzzFeed brand.
And Michael, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, you're a young reporter. You're all very young, but you're a young reporter at the Tampa Bay Times. What are your thoughts on the future of investigative reporting in the midst of all of these new ventures that do have quite a bit of cash?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think, excuse me, I think it's only going to get stronger. And, you know, you say I'm really young, but on this show, I'm the elder statesman of the investigative reporters here, right?
29?
Yeah, no, I'm 30.
30, okay.
28, and Will is 29. but no, I mean, look, the Tampa Bay Times right now, we are moving more and more into the digital realm every single day, but we're a robust and vital news-gathering operation, and I think this prize confirms that. And it, in my mind, it really doesn't matter where it happens. If you've got the people and you've got the drive to get these types of stories done, then you're doing the right thing. Hmm.
Well, I mean, your piece, your and Michael's, your and Will's piece is massive. I mean, I printed it out yesterday. I think there were, what, like 10 different stories focusing on the treatment of the Hillsborough County's homeless population, including children.
Yeah, Will's very long-winded. I tried to dial him back.
So just talk about why you decided to pursue this story in the beginning.
Well, I mean, I think it on its face, the reasons for pursuing it are clear. This was a great injustice that was being done at a local level. We knew going out that this wasn't the kind of thing that was going to that was going to get us a lot of attention or acclaim. You know, it's happening in our backyard, and it's one county. It's a little-known program. It only had a budget of about $1 million. But these were people, you know, these were vulnerable people who were suffering because of mismanagement, and we decided that we had to address that. We couldn't let that stand any longer.
And so what was the conversation like with your editor? And at that time, did you realize that so much reporting would be going into this?
Well, you know what? I'm on the newspaper's investigative team, so there wasn't a whole lot of horse trading that went into freeing me up to do this. But maybe Will would be better to talk about that.
Will?
We kind of came at this investigative or this investigation through sort of a side window. We had no idea how far and how deep it was actually going to go. We started with one story about one. I'm sorry, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
We started with one story about one slumlord, a public official in the Tampa area, and we did a series of stories about his one property. And then towards the end of that first week, after he resigned, was when we first heard that this property actually had people sent there from this county organization, and that their rent had been covered with tax dollars. And that's sort of when we pivoted from daily coverage of what was going on in and around this one slum area to kind of taking a step back and going, looking big picture, and how deep does this go? That's when we brought Michael in and brought the resources of our paper's investigative unit. And that's why we ended up writing so many stories, which is what you saw yesterday.
But I, I think to your question, the answer is that it was difficult. They had to make a choice to free Will up, and it wasn't an easy choice, but in the end, it was the right thing to do, and we hope that in those situations, again, we'll make similar decisions.
Well, and Chris, talk a little bit about how it works at the Center for Public Integrity. I mean, your piece, again, another explosive piece, looking at how doctors and lawyers worked at the behest of the coal industry, helped deny benefit claims of coal miners who were sick and dying of the black lung disease. How did you first find out about this issue?
Yeah, it's actually somewhat similar, it sounds like, to the way that my colleagues here came onto the story, which is just sort of by chance. And I think a lot of really great stories come about that way. I had done some earlier reporting. I'd done an earlier project with National Public Radio on the resurgence of black lung disease. A lot of people don't realize that there was landmark legislation in 1969 that caused, it was probably responsible for a significant reduction in the prevalence of the disease over a number of decades. But troublingly, in the late 1990s, that trend turned around. And since then, there's actually been an increase in prevalence of the disease, and the similarly troubling trend of younger miners getting a more severe form of the disease that progresses more quickly. And so it was out of that and out of talking with miners and their advocates and clinic workers and everyone in West Virginia and Virginia and Kentucky that you started hearing about the benefit system and how they felt it was completely stacked against them. And it was something that I just felt was pretty unwieldy and large, and I wasn't sure exactly how to tackle it, but it was I'd kind of put it aside, but it was the one man, really, Gary Fox, the miner who is featured in the first installment in the series. I simply could not ignore what happened to him. The doctors at Johns Hopkins, who were the subject of the second installment in the series, had looked at his x-rays and said he didn't have black lung. And the lawyers at a major law firm had withheld key evidence that showed that he had the most serious form of black lung. And as a result, he had to go back to work for a number of years, and he got extremely sick and then died waiting on a lung transplant. So it's that kind of thing that draws you into the story, and then you start to look at other patterns, such as the withholding of evidence by this law firm on a larger scale, and the role of doctors, particularly those at Johns Hopkins, on a large scale over a number of years.
That is Chris Hamby. He's an investigative reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. His year-long investigation won a Pulitzer Prize, exposing how doctors and lawyers worked at the behest of the coal industry to deny claims of coal miners who were sick and dying of the black lung disease. This is the first Pulitzer for the Center for Public Integrity. Will Hobson and Michael LaForgia are staff reporters with the Tampa Bay Times, and they won a Pulitzer for exposing a Florida government's agency's inhumane treatment of Hillsborough County's homeless population, which included children. The agency funneled millions of public dollars to slumlords and placed families in unsafe living conditions. Their stories led to the most significant reform of the county's social service programs in 20 years. And if you have any questions or comments for Will, Michael, or Chris about their pieces, we'd love to hear from you. And what are your thoughts on the state of investigative reporting? Again, we often get a lot of criticism for the media, and rightly so, but there is so much good journalism going on out there. It's just that sometimes it doesn't get the attention it deserves, or it just slowly goes away before enough people see it. So what are your thoughts on investigative reporting? What do you think needs attention? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And if you saw a piece this week that you'd like to talk about, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Chris, what was the process like when you took this story to your editors? Because again, it's rare for journalists to get a year to work on any given issue.
It is, and I was very fortunate. The Center for Public Integrity is a terrific place, and it's one of the few places in the country where you can do this sort of reporting, where you can essentially, more or less disappear for a year and then emerge with this massive thing that has to be, you know, edited and fact checked and sent to lawyers, and it's just it was a tremendous opportunity that I'm very grateful for. I think, you know, we didn't really know going into it how big of a story it was going to be. It started out, like I said, with the story of one man and what had happened to him. And then that sort of raises the question, well, has this happened on a larger scale basis? And yes, it looks like it has. And then so that, you know, sort of leads to a lot of reporting on the lawyers, which then, as I was reporting on the lawyers, led to a lot of reporting on the doctors. And so it sort of evolved. I think if we had set out at the beginning and said, we're going to do a year-long series, and what we're going to do is take on a notoriously litigious law firm and accuse them of withholding evidence, and we're going to challenge one of the top hospitals in the country, if not the world, of getting a bunch of medical readings wrong. I think that my editors probably would have said, you're insane, we don't have enough libel insurance for that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it just sort of evolved, and we, you know, over the year, we felt like we had the goods on this investigation, and by the end of it, we felt completely comfortable with what we had.
Will, did you all have a similar experience in your investigation? Because you were taking on high-profile politicians in this piece and exposing a lot of corruption in the process.
Right. Well, we actually we were done with the political official pretty early on in the investigation, and then that's when we pivoted to our coverage of the agency. And Michael and I actually had one interview very early on with the management of that agency, where I remember we both left in a state of shock that they had candidly admitted that they had been spending millions of dollars for years sending folks to substandard at best properties that would take these vouchers, and they had no safeguards in place, no inspections in place. They had no idea the condition of the places they were sending these people. Mechanism in place to capture complaints. It was just at that point we thought that there was a very good chance that we were going to trip over a lot of very bad things that happened to people. Hmm. And it was unfortunate that we did.
Well, and you went to some pretty scary places. I mean, you visited places where people lived among roaches that swarmed in every room, skittering across bathroom soap dishes and crawling over toothbrushes, or were forced to breathe moldy air, step over unmapped puddles of human waste, or sleep on mattresses infested with bedbugs. What went through your minds when you first came across all of this misery? How did you react, Michael? Were you surprised?
I decided I needed to change my clothes when I got back home, and you sit here and you think that these are the living conditions that that people sent by a local government are being forced to live in, and it's appalling. And you know, just for a moment to get back to your previous question for Will, because we learned that this was a powerful local figure who was operating here. When we learned that, we didn't. It's not that we hesitated for a second. I mean, we doubled down our efforts. Anytime we come across a situation where somebody in a position of power is taking advantage of weaker people, it's a situation that cries out for putting right.
Hmm. We're going to take a quick break. Michael LaForgia and Will Hobson are staff reporters at the Tampa Bay Times. They won a Pulitzer for their piece, Uncovering Corruption and the Inhumane Treatment of the Hillsborough County's Homeless Population. Chris Hamby is an investigative reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. He won a piece looking at how coal miners' benefits were denied, even though they were dying of black lung disease. It's your call. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll have a conversation with award-winning journalist and author Miriam Powell about her new book, The Crusades of Cesar Chavez, a biography. Chavez went from being a migrant worker to the leader of one of the most influential movements in the 20th century. So what do we need to know about one of the most significant Latino leaders in U.S. history? Who was Cesar Chavez and what is his legacy? And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our media roundtable, the day we connect you with journalists to talk about major stories of the week. And today, we are speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning reporters. The prizes were announced this week. And if you ever get depressed about the state of the media, and I often do, be sure to look at the prize winners and their work, because it is really amazing. There's a work looking at the NSA spying program, another excellent piece looking at the increasing number of people on food stamps. They put a face to these people. And then the poor treatment of veterans. And today we are joined by Will Hobson and Michael LaForgia, staff reporters at the Tampa Bay Times. And they won the Pulitzer for local reporting. They exposed the Hillsborough County Homeless Recovery Program's inhumane treatment of its homeless population, which also includes children. We're joined by Chris Hamby, an investigative reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. He's soon going over to BuzzFeed. His series, Breathless and Burdened, described how the coal industry beat back miners' claims for black lung health benefits, and he won for investigative reporting. And if you'd like to join us, we'll have a line open in a couple minutes at 866-798-8255. If you know of a really good investigative series or you saw a piece this week that you'd like to talk about, we'd love to hear from you. And if you have any questions about the current state of investigative reporting for our guests, you can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Gary in San Francisco. Hi, Gary. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, and congratulations to all of you on your prizes. I just am always curious to know about the pushback after these stories are published, especially when they're published about people who have expertise and resources at telling their own story. And that, you know, responding to criticism. So especially, Chris, I'm interested in knowing, you know, what was the aftermath? And I'll hang up, but I'll listen on the radio. Thank
okay.
you.
Thank you, Gary.
Well, thanks for your question, Gary. What we like to do, ideally, is to air it all out before the story even comes out. So if, you know, we want to give the people who are mentioned in our stories every opportunity possible to, you know, weigh in, discredit our information, tell us we're wrong, you know, threaten us, whatever it may be, in advance. And we want to include their perspective in the story. And that's what we did here. And we reached out extensively to both the law firm mentioned in the first installment and to Johns Hopkins, and really did not receive a lot of response from them. Johns Hopkins in particular demanded a large amount of information that would substantiate the claims that we were making. And we basically laid out what claims we were going to be making in the story. And they challenged those initially, said this can't be true. I FedExed them a large box of documents and a series of questions accompanying those that they had promised to answer, and they never did. And they instead sent us a statement that really didn't say much and was somewhat ambiguous, but we still tried to quote from that. In the aftermath of the stories, 2 days after the story came out, Johns Hopkins suspended this program at their clinic, and it remains suspended today pending a review. So we have not heard anything else from them. I think that's sort of speaks for itself. And then as far as the law firm, we have not heard anything from them since, which that has all been, frankly, somewhat surprising.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. So it's Jackson Kelly PLLC, and this is the law firm that withheld evidence that could have had significant consequences for sick minors and their families. So they haven't responded at all?
No, they have not really. They have said that essentially that they weren't going to comment on that there's an ongoing case involving Gary Fox, the miner mentioned in the first story, and they said that they would not comment while that case was ongoing. And then we asked them, you know, can you then comment on all these other cases that we mentioned or on your general practices? And they said essentially that the two were so intertwined that the issues raised in the case and their general practices were so intertwined that they wouldn't comment on any of it. So that has essentially been their position, and we haven't really heard anything more from them.
You report that this law firm defends companies accused of polluting the environment, marketing dangerous drugs, and discriminating against workers, and helps corporations avoid regulations, drafts bills, and lobbies legislators. Has there been much journalism about this law firm in the past?
There has not, and it's you know, it's a big, significant national law firm, although it has very, very deep roots in West Virginia and in particular in mining law. But it is very politically well connected, and there really has not been a lot about this firm before.
Well, again, be sure to read the piece. We've got links at our website. That's Chris Hamby, an investigative reporter with the Center for Public Integrity, who reported on doctors and lawyers working to deny benefits to coal miners who are suffering from black lung disease. And Michael, what about you? I mean, taking on and challenging power at the local level, what kind of pushback did you two get?
Well, I Will had a more front seat look at any of the pushback at the level. At one point, there was a rumor that a private investigator had been followed to tail him. I don't know if that's true or not. Nothing ever materialized from it. But, you know, it's part of our job to be fearless in the face of that, and that's what we did.
Will, what would you add?
The pushback, we actually had a pretty similar experience, I think, to Chris's in terms of the homeless agency initially denied sending people to live at these places. You know, they said, no, we give them a voucher, and they just go wherever in the area they can find that will accept our voucher. We have no involvement in directing them to a specific property. And we trolled through a couple hundred, I think it was a couple thousand emails and found dozens of examples of this politically connected slumlord emailing staffers and saying, hey, I have a few openings. You can send a family over right now. And we shipped those emails over and pretty much a silent response. And those two managers were the week after forced to resign.
You've got some pretty intense photos of these families that accompany your reporting. I mean, on, you know, old mattresses, and you can't really see the extent of the horror. Again, living among roaches, forced to breathe moldy air, human waste. But what did they tell you when you met them? What did they want people to know about their experience?
You know, one of the most powerful things that one of these guys said to me, and this was early on, I was talking to it was a couple, a man and a woman, who the girl was the woman was 9 months pregnant when this homeless agency sent them to live at this slumlord. Basically, it was a converted garage that he had subdivided into four 200 square foot living units. And I said, you know, why didn't you go back and tell them, you know, this is the guy's garage, there are roaches everywhere. And he said, you know, I was homeless. Like, when you're homeless, you're not going to complain about a place that a public agency sends you. And that's when it really hammered home to me that dozens, if not hundreds, of these people over here had felt that there was no point in complaining. No one was going to listen.
And in some cases, some of these people, Michael, were on the verge of dying.
Absolutely. And I can tell you that I heard the exact same thing, the things that Will heard when I spoke to people in some of these places that we visited. I mean, over and over again, the refrain was, where else can we go? Mm. And to me, it just completely underscored the failure, the utter failure of the local government to take care of these people, to do what they pledged that they were going to do.
Well, we've got a number of callers on the line, so let's go back to calls. And again, thanks for calling, Gary. Let's hear next from Margie in Monterey. Hi, Margie. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'd like to thank you for hosting this and hosting these guests. And I'd like to say to Will, Michael, and Chris, thank you so much for your excellent and courageous reporting efforts on these stories. I haven't had time to make my way through all of the stories yet, but they are fantastic so far. I live in Salinas, and at our hospital, we had millions that were funneled off to top administrators, and, you know, there was even a state investigation done, and no one was ever charged in that. You know, I was wondering, when it comes to the health care in West Virginia and in Virginia, and I'm not completely sure, but aren't those, at least one of those states, a state that has denied coverage through the healthcare system? And how does this affect those who are inflicted? Because I would think that if you're denied benefits like that, that it's going to further cover up people who are having these problems. And what is the benefit to the coal industry? And whether or not, the people that are involved, can they be prosecuted? It seems to me like there's deep pockets in this area.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling in. Chris, do you know in West Virginia and Virginia, are the governors denying Medicare treatment like so many other governors across the country?
You know, I would have to check on that. But what I can say is that the miners overwhelmingly rely on local clinics, and some of them are funded through HHS, Health and Human Services, grants, is a fairly small amount of money. And that's where they go a lot of times. And I've been to these clinics, and they'll get, you know, treatment, and they'll sometimes help them file for claims. But I can tell you when these clinics, I mean, they oftentimes have good doctors and nurses and people there helping them, and lay representatives to help them in their claim, but it's just they're simply, when it comes to a very arcane administrative law system, it's no match for a national law firm and someplace like Johns Hopkins or Case Western Reserve, which also has a doctor who has weighed in repeatedly, or the University of Cincinnati, or some of these other places. So they're really, these guys, it's a real uphill battle for them, and the care that they would get, what they're asking for in filing a benefits claim is basically medical care and a monthly allotment of somewhere between a little over $600 and maxing out at $1,250 for a minor who has three or more dependents. So this is really,
wow.
We're talking about peanuts here. But nonetheless, the coal industry fights tooth and nail virtually every claim.
And are we talking Massey specifically, or a number of coal companies?
No, this is pretty much across the spectrum. Now, Gary Fox, a miner mentioned in the first story, did work for his last job, and the initial litigation was against a subsidiary for Massey. Massey, of course, now has been bought by Alpha Natural Resources, which has continued to challenge Gary's claim and his surviving widow's claim. But no, we saw this across the spectrum with virtually all of the, you know, the large coal companies in the country.
Well, after Will and Michael's piece ran, actually the day after they revealed that the agency sent clients to live in substandard apartments, the manager of the Hillsborough County Homelessness Agency resigned a day after, and he's worked there, Jim Silverwood, since 1989, earning $72,000 a year. Chris, again, you said that following your reports, John Hopkins suspended suspended the Black Lung program, and then U.S. senators crafted reform legislation. Members of Congress are asking for a federal investigation. But did anyone specifically lose their jobs over colluding to ensure that the coal industry doesn't have to provide these miners with basic health care?
So that remains up in the air. There are ongoing investigations. We don't know. The Maryland Medical Board would be the one that has the authority to oversee Johns Hopkins and take any action there. They will not say on the record what, if anything, they're doing. And as far as the lawyers' involvement here, the West Virginia Disciplinary Council has opened three investigations into lawyers at Jackson Kelly, and there's the possibility of more happening there.
Because you found that they have a record of withholding evidence that could have significant consequences for these miners. Is that even legal?
Well, that's the question. And there are a number of questions. And the first question is it legal? The second question is it ethical? And then those both fall within the arena of what could play out in the courts or in the disciplinary system. And then there's sort of a third question that we all need to ask ourselves, which is this moral? there is, as many people who have experience with the legal system know, there is a difference between legal and moral. And that's a question that we all have to ask to answer for ourselves. What Jackson Kelly's position has been is that that they haven't denied that this is what they do. They've simply said there's nothing wrong with it. And there have been decisions on both sides of that, with judges harshly criticizing this approach and calling it ludicrous and a pattern of misconduct. But at the same time, there have really been mixed rulings on this.
That is Chris Hamby, an investigative reporter with the Center for Public Integrity, who is soon going over to BuzzFeed. His series, Breathless and Burdened, described how the coal industry beat back miners' claims for black lung health benefits. He just was awarded the Pulitzer for investigative reporting. Will Hobson and Michael LaForgia are staff reporters with the Tampa Bay Times. They won for the local reporting category, and they exposed the Hillsborough County Homeless Recovery Program's inhumane treatment of its homeless population. And thank you again for calling in, Margie. Let's go next to Richard in Oakland. Hi, Richard. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I want to thank you guys for the work you're doing. A couple of questions. Yesterday, by coincidence, I was talking to a woman about journalism. She had been in television journalism, and I was asking her what her deep thoughts were, her concerns were about journalism today. So these are general questions. She said she thought journalism today, in general, was like junk food. And obviously, you guys are exceptions to that, thankfully. But she said, in her opinion, public trust in journalism was just gone in this country. So I wonder what your reflections are or what your take is on the question of trust, public trust, in terms of material that is sent out as news.
Well, thank you. Michael, do you want to take that one first?
Well, I personally haven't experienced a huge deficit of public trust in my interactions with the people that we work with every day. Mm-hmm. And all we can hope to do, all we can control is what we focus on, what we shed light on. And if we keep doing stories like Chris did, and if we keep focusing a light on government mismanagement like Will and I did, then I think that public trust will not suffer for that.
Will, what do you think?
I'd have to know more about who the person is making that statement. I mean, there are folks who have problems with their perceived political leanings of different newspapers or media organizations. But I think the wonderful thing about what's happening right now in our industry is that there are all these small startups that are out there. You have Vox, you have 538, I think that if someone doesn't trust their local paper, I encourage them to seek out a media organization that they do trust. I mean, when we do good investigative work, we lay out the sources for you. We show you what we consulted, how we put together a story, we're pretty open about it. So So yeah, I certainly don't feel in the Tampa Bay area that folks have lost any trust in the journalism we're producing on a daily basis.
What's the relationship like between your readers and the paper? What was the reaction to your investigative stories?
I mean, it was it was outrage. You know, the politically connected gentleman that we identified in the first series of stories resigned under pressure because folks were furious that he'd been doing this for years. Hillsborough County taxpayers, as you can imagine, even those who are not sympathetic to the plight of the underclass, certainly do not want to see millions of tax dollars going to these conditions. So, you know, we really didn't get any pushback.
And Chris, do you want to briefly also answer Richard's question about public trust?
A lot of times when I hear people criticize the media, and I'm not trying to give print journalists and our ilk the pass on this, but I think a lot of the criticism that I hear is more of TV punditry,
right,
or radio punditry, which I would draw a distinction between that and a lot of reporting that goes on. I think what Will and Michael and a lot of other people have done in this last year shows that, you know, in large part, journalism is very healthy and still doing great stuff. And it's just that those loud voices get a lot of attention. And I would encourage people to go to some of these. If you're tired of your big media outlet, go to some of these smaller ones. You know, go to your local paper or go to these alternative nonprofit investigative sites that are popping up across the country. I have not personally experienced that much of a lapse in trust for what our organization does, and I'm very hopeful, actually. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, thank you again for calling in, Richard. Let's hear next from Carmel in Santa Cruz. Hi, Carmel. Welcome to the show.
I want to talk to you about the food stamp program. And it got me started when I heard a comment. I'm not against all Republicans. One Republican said, and then I did my own investigation. And what I found, I was like sick to my stomach. I'm shaking because I've never talked on the radio before. So anyway, when
you're
the Republicans said we're going to cut the food stamp program more, that they out there seem to be doing okay. Hmm. And the way he said there, they, and out there, I just couldn't believe it, you know? So I started calling all these people that I'm acquainted with or ran into them to find out they do get food stamps. My question is how much? And a typical woman who is disabled and blind gets $15 a month.
Mm.
Now, you can't even buy two loaves of bread for $15. Another person, she said, well, she felt good because she got 20 and one got 24 because of the area they live in. I was appalled that they keep talking about cutting all these programs. Plus, I'm a senior citizen. They want to cut all programs. I don't get where people think that's a good idea. Mm. I think the cheaters and the ones that are fraud and the ones that's taken the money from everybody is the corporations and the rich. They have teams of lawyers. They have every loophole so they don't have to pay their fair share.
Well, interesting you say that because a number of tax justice organizations put out information about that on Tax Day, about all of the corporate tax dodgers, but that really didn't get much media attention on Tax Day.
And I think reporters are doing really well. You just have to find your news in other places.
Well,
and there's so much out there. And I think the average Joe out there just listens to, you know, the national news for a half hour and something else, and they take that, and there's nothing there.
Well, thank you for calling, and maybe we'll invite Eli Saslow. He won a Pulitzer for the Washington Post for his piece on people who receive food stamps, and maybe we'll invite him on in the near future. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, well, thank you so much for calling. We are almost out of time. I think we have time for one more caller. Let's hear from Lee in Palo Alto. Hi, Lee. We're almost out of time.
Oh, yeah, I'll be quick. I heard the author of the Vanity Fair article on Edward Snowden talk about how he had access to all of the material, and I'd never heard this before. Apparently, his job as a contractor was to duplicate all of the information on the hard drive at NSA headquarters and copy it onto the computer in Hawaii, because they were worried that if there was a communication breakdown, Hawaii NSA would not have the same information.
Hmm.
So his job was to copy all of that information. His coworkers complained that he was using so much bandwidth that their computers were kind of logging out. And my question, well, first of all, that was startling information.
Well, you know, I'm sorry to cut you off, but we only have about a minute left, but we will definitely look into this and possibly invite that reporter on in the future. Thank you for calling, and we'll find it and put a link on our website. We've got just about a minute left. Will Hobson, what are you working on right now?
I'm working on losing the weight I gained.
Yeah.
It's a celebration. I'm now the county reporter here in Hillsborough County, and I'm working on getting up to speed on my beat, meeting sources, and looking for the next project.
And Michael, what are you working on?
Oh, I've got a couple of things going. We're going to look at the school system here and some inequalities that are ongoing, and then possibly take a look at some social services things involving foster children.
And Chris, what are you working on?
Well, I've got a few things swirling around. I'm anxious to get started at BuzzFeed on May 1st, and I plan to continue doing the sort of things that Will, Michael, and I did last year, which is sort of, you know, focusing on the intersection of powerless and voiceless populations and institutions of power.
Please do, and thank you so much for doing that. Will Hobson and Michael LaForgia are staff reporters at the Tampa Bay Times. They exposed the Hillsborough County Homeless Recovery Program's inhumane treatment of its homeless population. Chris Hamby is an investigative reporter with the Center for Public Integrity, moving on to BuzzFeed soon. His series, Breathless and Burdened, described how the coal industry beat back miners' claims for black lung health benefits. Thank you all for joining us, and again, congratulations and thank you for your work.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you, and thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Who is Cesar Chavez, and what was his legacy? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with award-winning journalist and author Miriam Powell about her new book, The Crusades of Cesar Chavez, a biography. Chavez went from being a migrant worker to leading one of the most influential movements in the 20th century, inspiring generations of activists and community organizers. So what do we need to know about one of the most significant Latino leaders in U.S. history? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulip is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.